Welcome to the New Books Network.
So you had a somewhat unreal, surreal, I would even say, set of circumstances where officials were meeting with the private sector. We were engaged in dialogue, but they would come to the meeting and say, this is not a formal restructuring, and we have no mandate to engage in a formal restructuring. Meanwhile, the market pressure was growing by the day.
Welcome back to In the Room. I'm Tim Jones. I write the 24/2 Substack newsletter. I'll admit it's been a long break, but this is a new series of interviews now hosted by the New Books Network with people who were in the room when recent European history was being written. Today's conversation is with a non-European who was nevertheless a pivotal figure in the resolution of Europe's sovereign debt crisis. Back in 2010 to 2012, it was an American, Charles de Laura, who together with Jean Lemierre, now the chairman of BNP Paribas, who negotiated what is still the world's biggest ever debt restructuring, a €100 billion write-off of Greek government bonds. As the managing director of the Institute of International Finance, the IIF, de Laura and a gang of four colleagues represented the banks and other institutions holding those bonds. As Europe's governments and institutions assumed more and more Greek debt in an attempt to contain financial contagion into the rest of the periphery, and especially into Italian markets, de Laura and Lemierre walked a fine line between accepting bigger losses for their members and preventing a catastrophic collapse in the system. In his new memoir, Euroshock, published today by Rodin Books, de Laura looks back on these years and details the negotiations, the IMF's moving goalposts, the disarray on the official side, and the roles of, among others, Chancellor Merkel and President Sarkozy. I bring you Charles de Laura. At one of the many meetings you write about in this book, you say, quote, "I looked around the room and saw only Europeans, senior distinguished Europeans, except for me, the sole American. This was their continent, their common currency, their future. I was an interloper. My Italian father and an Irish mother meant virtually nothing in that room." So I saw this as an opportunity really to do your backstory, to look at your upbringing in South Carolina, your career before the IIF and the Treasury Department, and how it felt being an interloper during what was Europe's most consequential crisis until the pandemic came along.
Well, I grew up in a working class family in a fairly small, somewhat parochial town in the northwest corner of South Carolina. My European roots were made much more evident to me when I visited my aunts and uncles in New York during the summer, because my father had been raised in the Bronx, and I still had aunts and uncles who lived there. And so I became somewhat comfortable with and familiar with those roots over the years of my youth by visiting my extended family in the Bronx part of New York City. In the South at the time, ethnic identification was not, particularly from various European roots, was not as strong as it was in many other parts of the states at that time. I did my university study at my home state university, where I went through a naval officer training program. This was Vietnam wartime in America, and healthy young men like me didn't ask themselves whether they were going to serve. They just asked how they're going to serve. And I threw my hat in the ring for a naval scholarship and was fortunate enough to win one. And in return, they gave me 4 good years of university education, and I gave them 4 years of active duty after. Much of that time was spent actually in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean, serving on a guided missile destroyer. And then, interestingly, perhaps coincidentally, perhaps not, I ended up being transferred to Greece when the ship and handful of other ships were actually moved in terms of home porting, in terms of basing, from the East Coast to Athens. And this provided my first real exposure to the Greek culture, to the Greek people, to the Greek language, and indirectly to the Greek economy. And it was an exposure that lingered in my mind for many years until I was thrust back into the Greek environment in a much more turbulent situation. Following my naval service, I ended up at graduate school where I had wanted really all along to study international finance and international economics, and did a special program, Tim, at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University in the Boston area, which enabled me to focus on international economics, but to blend it with some study of diplomacy, study of international history, study of international economic development, and international law. And that multidisciplinary approach apparently prepared me rather well for the Treasury Department, where I began as a civil servant and was fortunate enough to work my way up the line in the 1980s under Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, to the point where I was Assistant Secretary, basically leading all of international affairs at the Treasury Department. I then went into the private sector first for a few years with J.P. Morgan, doing investment at banking in Central Europe and the Middle East as the Iron Curtain fell away, and then was offered this opportunity to lead and re-energize in some ways the Institute of International Finance, which I did for almost two decades, Tim, during which we built it into quite a credible and I think reasonably effective association representing the interests of banks, insurance firms, investment banks, pension funds, and even private equity firms. And that experience building the IIF involved a fair amount of engagement on both regulatory issues, but also on sovereign debt issues. And perhaps my experience at the Treasury, where I dealt with a lot of sovereign debt issues in the 80s, as Latin America went through a difficult decade dealing with their own sovereign debt issues, perhaps those years at the Treasury, along with my work at the IIF, prepared me for this, for stepping into this Greek crisis.
I'm glad you raised the Latin American negotiations you did, because you observe in the book, quote, "For the first time, the private sector pulled the trigger to open the negotiations rather than being dragged into it by the official sector." Why do you think that was in the Greek case?
Well, I think there were two dominant reasons. One was that there was such a strong resistance in certain European quarters to embracing the idea of a debt restructuring for a country that was part of the euro. And this resistance was led by the European Central Bank, but it was also a view shared by most other senior officials in Europe as the Greek situation deteriorated. We, on the other hand, as the creditors, began to see more and more tension revolving around the Greek debt, and there was some degree of growing recognition at an analytical level that this debt was unsustainable. That became increasingly evident in my view, Tim, after a meeting took place in Deauville, France, in the fall of 2010, when Chancellor Merkel and President Sarkozy issued a statement that indicated quite clearly that banks and creditors, private creditors that were exposed to Greece and other countries which may need exceptional support would be expected to participate in a restructuring exercise. Their words were not quite so explicit as I'm using now, but that was the clear message. That message actually, unfortunately, accelerated the need for a debt restructuring because it frightened market investors who were still at that time hoping and anticipating that there might still be a recovery of the Greek economy and restoration of debt sustainability without the need of a restructuring. Finally, I think that we made the decision in the spring of 2011 because of growing concerns that unless the Greek problem was addressed, that the pressures would build to potentially an unmanageable level on Italy as well. And we felt, therefore, that this wasn't just about Greek debt and the Greek role in the Eurozone, but it was really increasingly about the ability of the Eurozone to remain intact and the Euro to remain intact, that without the restructuring, those pressures were, in our view, becoming increasingly unmanageable. So even though we knew that there was still resistance to a restructuring in some quarters, we've been having enough conversations to realize that there was some growing sense of recognition in many places that a restructuring was inevitable. And so we decided to go ahead and launch the process in the spring of 2011.
It's funny, I remember that attitude, particularly coming from Jean-Claude Trichet and the parts of the ECB, that, as you put it, this unshakable view that no Eurozone debt could be written off, that it would debase the European signature. And I remember talking to a senior French official at the time who considered this view to be quite Eurocentric to the point of chauvinism, the idea that only emerging markets, only developing countries were allowed to restructure their debt. That wasn't for Europeans. Did you share that view at the time?
Well, I wouldn't have used the term chauvinistic, to be quite honest with you, Tim. I did think, and I understood, let me be clear, I understood Jean-Claude's thinking because I had worked with him for decades. He'd been a tremendously capable director du Trésor, which is the senior civil servant in the French Treasury, for many years before he became president of the Banque de France and then president of the ECB. He had believed, as had most who were intricately involved in the creation of the euro, that once the euro was created, that the credibility of each country's debt inside that euro structure was sacrosanct. And I don't think it was a view of any degree of thinking that it's a division between European countries and emerging markets. I think he felt that they had locked in, that each country had committed to lock in its future financially into the euro structure. And part of that commitment was to honor its debt. That view, I think, I understood was deeply held. But at the same time, there was a contradiction embedded in that, Tim. And that contradiction was that countries were committed and they had given up their own currency, in the case of Greece, the drachma, for the benefits of joining a unified currency. But at the same time, they had not unified their debt structure. And so each country still had its own sovereign debt issued into the markets. And as we knew, increasingly from the time that Papandreou announced that the fiscal deficit was much larger than had been understood, and this was in the fall of 2009, it was clear that the tensions between that commitment to a common currency on the one hand and that diversity of fiscal stature being sovereign-related still and being held in the markets as a sovereign risk, not as a unified risk, as an independent sovereign risk, that contradiction became increasingly unmanageable, Tim. And this is why, again, we felt like something had to move here. And, you know, the Germans had cautioned during the period of the 2000s that they were not guaranteeing Greek debt or Italian debt or Portuguese debt, et cetera. But the market didn't listen. And they, frankly, must not have believed this. And I think this is part of what led to the difficulties that Greece encountered.
I want to get into some of the color of the book because it really is full of inside stories. Let's begin with, while we have said that you did preempt the Eurozone authorities, you were actually sounded out by the PASOK government in Greece pretty early on with this meeting you had with George Papandreou in Davos.
Well, that initial meeting was a kind of a constructive meeting, but it was held in a moment where I don't think either Papandreou or those of us representing the private sector fully appreciated the depth of the problem. He had developed a coherent adjustment program and presented that program to Bill Rhodes and me around the edges of Davos in early 2010. If my memory serves me correctly, it was called Program for Sustained Growth. And while it was coherent, it was not overly ambitious. And at that point, the markets had already begun the process of freezing out Greece from the global capital markets. But the degree of and depth of adjustment embedded in that initial program was not sufficient to recapture confidence. I didn't fully appreciate that until I did go back to Athens a month or two later and spent a good bit of time again with the prime minister, but more importantly with Papakonstantinou, the finance minister, and other key members of the cabinet, and also talked extensively with private bankers and businessmen in Greece. And it was at that point that I think I began to fully appreciate the severity of the problem. And I think that Prime Minister Papandreou was well-intended. He, like most European officials, had not at that stage begun to contemplate the need for a serious debt restructuring and was of the view initially that a Greek adjustment program would rebuild confidence sufficiently to regain access for Greece in the global capital markets. Of course, as the year unfolded, it became increasingly clear that that was not the case. Of course, the IMF had already stepped in at that point. And again, there was a hope that an IMF European-wide supported program would be sufficient. But by the time we ended up turning the corner on 2010, moving into 2011, as I explained earlier, the hopes of the European authorities that this problem could be solved without a major debt restructuring were increasingly dim, in my view. I do remember you mentioned the meeting with Papandreou in Davos. I think two important elements of context are important here. One is that Ireland had already been through a difficult, extremely stressful year or so by the time the crisis really expanded in Greece. So the Eurozone was already under a cloud. And the Irish crisis, of course, was largely related to bank exposure to the real estate sector. It was not so deeply embedded in the structure of the economy. The U.S., on the other hand, was showing signs of life coming out of the global financial crisis. But the European banks themselves had also suffered as a result of the global financial crisis due to their exposure to subprime real estate off-balance sheet, in many cases, products which had been inappropriately valued leading up to the global financial crisis. The point I'm trying to make here, Tim, is that I think that the cloud surrounding the Eurozone as a whole initially began to really, I think, weigh on the entire European economy as we moved through 2010, and Greece was only a part of that problem. Portugal, Italy, Spain, all see as having fundamental imbalances which posed a risk to global investors. But as these countries began to grapple, each in its own way, with the problem, the severity of the Greek and, to a certain extent, Italian problem became much more evident and much more at the center of what I call a vortex there that it seemed to pull Greece and Italy under the water's edge. Every time they took a step forward, it seemed like they were pulled two steps back.
Because the book is so focused on a very short period, I mean, you talk about your naval past and you have prescriptions for the future, but the core of the book is this very focused period from 2010 to early 2012. And it's really fascinating insight to an outsider into how negotiations work. And I followed really all of this stuff from the outside. And I've always wondered how it is that negotiators can bargain in real time without having to go back to the principles. And it's clear in the book that you often did, but you didn't always. How did you choose when to do that? And there is the example you cite where one of the principals of one of the big French banks really loses it with you while you're on the phone with him in Turkey.
Well, you're right to put a focus on this issue of how you maintain a sense of common direction in the midst of what at the time seemed like a very disorganized and occasionally, frankly, chaotic set of negotiations. I had learned through my years at the Treasury that you really have to work up and down the line, as I would call it. Down the line to make sure that you and your team around you and your staff are debating issues, exploring issues, doing all the hard work and hard analysis so that the credible options to going forward are carefully thought out. But more, perhaps equally importantly, I would say, maintaining a constant dialogue, in this case, with the board of directors of the Institute and the key European creditors, was an imperative for me. And very few days went by when I did not either organize a full-scale board call or, as we moved through a rapid series of meetings, more often a series of individual calls with key bankers, key creditors, and not just the bankers. There were people like Andre de Castro, who was running AXA at the time. AXA had significant exposure to Greece. It was not, paradoxically, it was not a member of the Institute of International Finance at the time. We were a membership organization. But I assured him that we would treat their exposure in the same even-handed way we would any other European creditor. And in the end of the day, of course, he saw that proved to be the case and brought his firm into our membership. But the more important point I wanted to stress is that there's no substitute for briefing senior bankers and listening to their feedback. I stayed in virtually constant touch with Joe Ackerman and with other key bankers, including Baldwin Crowe. Now, my job with Crowe was a bit less frequent because I had the benefit of having a great partner. For the first 6 months, he was an informal partner, but then we structured the negotiating team in a more formal way in the fall of 2011, and Jean Lemierre became more formally the co-chair of the committee, which I had led up to that point. But formally or informally, Jean, who was a senior advisor at the time to Pro as the chairman of BNP Paribas, was well positioned to also liaise with Pro. And then, but I maintained a frequent dialogue as well with the CFO level in the firms involved. And was this exhausting? It was at times. I had two extremely capable deputies working with me from the Institute, whom I mentioned in the book. And they were also Hung Tran and Mikos Hadjimichael. And Mikos, being of Cypriot origin, spoke Greek fluently and was a tremendous asset when it came to translating Greek documents and sorting through some realities about the Greek economy, because he had grown up and lived in the Greek world and had done his initial schooling there as well. But I really think that one of the reasons why we were ultimately able to convince the creditors to agree to such an enormous, unprecedented haircut was because we had stayed in close touch with them all along. Now, that's not to say we didn't have differences of view. And sometimes Ackerman and I would take different perspectives on an issue. And that's natural. He was the leader of one of Europe's largest banks at the time, in addition to being chairman of the board of the Institute. He had his own different prisms through which he looked at things. But, you know, if you engage in enough dialogue, I've learned, even with people on the opposite side of an issue, even in this case with European officials, there will be a process where divergent positions begin to narrow, and that's what eventually happened in this set of negotiations.
The contrast could hardly be starker with what you were met with Vittorio Grilli repeatedly. I mean, you mentioned it several times in the book about how he was nominally the chief negotiator with you as chairman of the Eurogroup Working Group. He kept telling you he had no mandate repeatedly, but you begin the book with this story about where you finally crack him, and he tells you, okay, I'll take you to people who have a mandate. Could you tell us that story?
Let me preface that by saying that I never faulted really personally for this dilemma that he faced, but structurally, it made the negotiations with him extremely circular and without forward movement for a number of months. Tim, and this was, of course, a huge frustration because Europe was still, imagine they were already engaged in negotiating a restructuring, but had never formally endorsed it at the meeting of ministers or at the head of states. And that's because during those first few months, Trichet and others at the ECB were still adamantly opposed. So you had a somewhat surreal, I would even say, set of circumstances where officials were meeting with the private sector. We were engaged in dialogue, but they would come to the meeting and say, this is not a formal restructuring, and we have no mandate to engage in a formal restructuring. Meanwhile, the market pressure was growing by the day, Tim. And so I did, and I was not alone. I mean, Lemierre and I and our small band of warriors there were increasingly frustrated on that night. And in October when it seemed that still, after all these months of negotiations, because these negotiations had really started in earnest back in June, we didn't have someone on the other side of the table who had a mandate to actually negotiate and move positions in a meaningful fashion on crucial issues relating to the restructuring. How much debt we were going to restructure? What would be the legal framework around the restructured debt? What would be the interest rate on the newly issued debt, et cetera? And so at that moment in October to which you refer, we were admittedly very exasperated. We happened to be meeting in the bowels of the Baron Lamont building, I think it is called, where the European Union held all of its major, this commission headquarters building, which I'm sure you know very well, and where the leaders of Europe held their regular ministerial and head of state meeting. And so at that point, it just seemed to us it was utterly fruitless to continue the negotiations. Mind you, the Greeks had a seat at the table, two competent, capable Greek officials. But they did not have the authority either to negotiate on behalf of their own country, which I found very unfortunate and in its own way a bit depressing, because here you had Greece in the center of the storm, but without an ability to take any ownership for how the storm could be addressed. That evening, fortunately, really responded to our frustrations. And let me say one other thing. The awkwardness of the situation was also exaggerated by the fact that by that point in late October of 2011, as you may recall, the center of the euro crisis had really come down to focus on these two countries. It did not mean that Portugal, Ireland, Spain were completely out of the woods, but each in their own way had found a path moving toward stability, moving toward regaining market access. But neither Italy nor Greece had discovered that path at all. So here you had the poor Italian finance minister concerned that his own country could be dragged to the bottom of the depths of the Mediterranean, trying to represent Greece. And there was just no organizational or substantive logic to it. So when he finally told us he'd found someone with the authority to negotiate, we were excited. And we found that someone really was the senior leadership of all of Europe, Mr. Juncker, who at the time was leading the ministerial, Mr. Barroso, who, as you know, was president of the commission, and most importantly, of course, Chancellor Merkel and President Sarkozy.
And you got a full Sarkozy at that meeting, a performative.
that's one way to describe it. I am sure that no one in that room would debate the fact, and Grilli was there, and so was Christine Lagarde, would debate the fact that that Sarkozy lashed into Lemierre and me. I think we though stood our ground, and we realized that he was partly sincerely delivering a message, and partly I think he was at that moment somewhat of a showman. And fortunately, we had the benefit there because he was threatening us. There was no doubt he was threatening us. And it's not the first time that I've been threatened by senior officials over my many years. If you don't do this, I'm going to do that. And I don't think we were too troubled by it. But it was very fortunate that Merkel brought her much calmer demeanor into the picture and actually began to discuss the specifics of what eventually became the restructuring. And she moved us to a deeper, larger restructuring. And at the same time, after some debate, she eventually reaffirmed that Europe would not only extend additional substantial loans to Greece along with the IMF, but that Europe would also provide some substantial amount of funds to underpin the restructuring itself.
Let's come to the final stages of the negotiations, because these are really interesting and you covered them in quite some detail. The goalposts kept moving because the IMF's changes to their debt sustainability analysis, and they were fixated on this 120% of GDP You say that 120 took on biblical proportions, and you describe this negotiation going on till 2 a.m. with Thomas Wieser, who was then the Eurogroup Working Group chairman, running in and out to try and get IMF confirmation for your own staff's calculations. And then you had to go in search of a printer. It's an absolutely bizarre story.
True. Well, what triggered this phase of the negotiations was something that, in looking back upon it, still was probably the most remarkable moment in the whole negotiations, is when Chancellor Merkel stood up, walked across the room, handed me a draft communique, and said, "Mr. Dallaire, Monsieur Lemierre, I know you're not too happy with everything we're trying to do here, but I think we've reached some understandings here tonight, and why don't you look at some of the language, particularly around the 120% issue, and let us know what you can live with." And we did. And I was determined, Jean and I should say, were determined that we would soften the commitment to the 120% target, which Merkel had demonstrated during the dialogue that she was aware that it was too rigid and too much a center of focus, because there never was. Look, I've been working in sovereign debt for decades, and there was never anything magical about 120% of debt to GDP for any country, Greece, Japan, the U.S., you name it. I mean, there are too many other factors that come into play in determining debt sustainability. But the IMF had become fixated on this, and so had German finance minister, sadly deceased now, Schäuble. And the two of them could not let go of this 120% figure. So we softened the language around that to make it more of a goal rather than a firm, ironclad commitment. And then we modified a few adjectives and adverbs. We didn't change fundamentally the thrust of the communique language. And of course, there was much in the communique that we were smart enough to know we had nothing to do with, and we better not be fooling around with language about Italy or language about this or that or the other. But then we didn't want to bring back to Chancellor Merkel a marked up thing. And so we tried to get computers operating there to edit the document. And finally, we were able to find a guard who was kind enough, and literally in the bowels of the building, to fire up his computer, to make the changes for us, and to run the printing machine so that we could run a few copies up to Merkel, and really had been waiting impatiently for that to happen. It's just one of these small incidents which where the future of Europe may have partly hinged upon the collaboration of a security guard at the commission staff.
Finally, I mean, looking back, as you say, 120% of GDP clearly wasn't an issue for Greece. They're substantially higher than that now. But a very large part of their debt is officially held. They haven't had to repay anything on it yet. And if they were in the kind of circumstances we're in now, with interest rates having risen very sharply over the last 2 years, they really would be in something of a predicament. So do you think the official debt will eventually be repaid?
You know, without trying to dodge that question, I don't really think that that's a primary objective of anyone at this point. I think that as long as Greece continues on this impressive path of restoring fiscal stability, which they've done quite remarkably well on in these last years, of restoring debt sustainability, notwithstanding the continued high levels of debt, I don't think that it's going to be a huge issue if there is eventually a need to roll over any of the European debt. But I'm not sure that that will be required. It seems to me that what's happened, I think, and there isn't quite a full appreciation of how important the reduction of interest charges, both by the private creditors and the official creditors, has been on Greece's debt sustainability, because we eliminated on that one day, I think it was March 9th, 3 days and 12 years ago now, we eliminated over 100 billion euro of debt, roughly a little bit more than half of the GDP of Greece. But importantly, what we also did, which attracted less fanfare, but I think is now becoming a serious a significant positive factor is we gave Greece 10 years grace period on the repayment of any principal to the private sector. And we agreed that we would provide subsidized interest rates on the new debt for another 20 years, and the level of subsidy gradually being reduced. The net effect of this was that it not only lowered the debt service burden on Greece, but it also reportedly helped catalyze significant concessions on interest rate charges by Europe. As you may recall, Europe persistently refused to reduce the underlying value of any of its debt. And I understood that that was very difficult because of the nature of the construct of the Eurozone, national constitutions, etc. And so even though from an economic point of view, the IMF and the private sector both were hoping that Europe would actually reduce the nominal value of its outstanding debt, they never did. But what they did was nevertheless very meaningful because they reduced interest charges significantly as well. And so today, Greece's debt remains quite high, but the actual debt service burden is quite manageable. At the same time, the IMF has finally acknowledged that there is and never was anything magical about 120% of debt to GDP. I'm just so disappointed that they never recognized it in the heat of the moment and cannot bring themselves to acknowledge that. And so now what we have is a whole new approach at the IMF to debt sustainability. And I think that approach really is focused much more on the gross, as they call it, the gross financing needs, GFN, to use some of the acronyms which the IMF uses now, which basically means, you know, how much do you really need to service your debt? Greece has made such progress over the last few years. Frankly, it's still got a lot of underlying structural issues that need to be addressed. But it was no dramatic surprise to me that in December, The Economist magazine recognized Greece as the country of the year, and not just for its economic comeback, which is impressive enough, but because also they have a leader now who has found a way to position himself in the center of a democratic process there, which was under such tremendous strain less than a decade ago.
That is a good place to end. So, Charles, thank you very much for your time.
It's really a pleasure talking with you today, Tim. Glad to be with you.